Come right in, pull up a chair. It's time once again to gather around the gaming table with your friends at The Gaming Gang. Proudly sponsored by Victory Point Games. This time around, Elliot will be reviewing Legions of Darkness from Victory Point Games and Consensus Movie Edition from Mind Logic Inc. Jeff will be reviewing Lock and Load's Forgotten Heroes Vietnam and Fast Action Battle Sicily from GMT. We'll have news, views, and much more on this episode of The Gaming Gang. Now here's your hosts, Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller.
Hi, I'm Jeff McAleer.
And I am Elliot Miller.
How are you doing today, buddy?
Not bad, man. It's been a rough couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah. Work-wise?
Oh, my gosh. I had so much work, and then I had two cars break down that I had to figure out. I'm driving a 95 Honda Civic. Daughter's driving a, 41 Honda Accord.
A 1941 Honda Accord? I didn't realize
right. Those are the kamikaze ones. So I do appreciate you taking care of things while I have been completely swamped with everything. But I'm going to be a lot more visible now that things are hopefully settling down.
Very cool. Well, I have to admit, I'm kind of irritated tonight. And hopefully you can kind of talk me down off the ledge.
Well, I hope so. It wasn't me, right?
No. Not at all.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
Somebody emailed me and said, oh, hey, you know, you really should check out this blog. And I'm not going to say what the blog is.
That's fine.
And this person really covers a lot of stuff about gaming. And you know, maybe you'd want to be interested in adding them as a correspondent, right? I thought, okay, I'll take a look at the blog. And there's a lot of stuff there. Don't get me wrong. But the thing that I found striking, and I only read a few pieces, was this person not even really gave me the impression. They flat out basically were saying they don't like games. They had their listing of their games of the year for 2011, and they had broken it up in like three categories. And I'm reading through it, and they hated everything. And the worst part of it was they didn't even say why they didn't like the game. They just said, oh, well, you know, it just didn't do it for me. What didn't it do? Did it not rub your back when you were done playing? What? But there was one section, it was war games.
Okay.
And one of the titles that they had mentioned was No Retreat from GMT, which is actually originally a Victory Point Games title.
Yes.
And it's part of that strategic alliance that GMT has with VPG.
Yes.
They put it up on their P500, so it's not automatically being published.
All right.
And this person wrote, they were looking forward to checking out No Retreat, and of course they weren't happy with it, and they said, even with its Victory Point Games pedigree.
You see, that's effed up.
Because yeah, I'm right with you.
You know as well as I do that they put out some damn good games.
Yes,
it may
do.
Be the, not the best component quality, but they put out some damn good games.
I know. And that irritated me when I saw that. And then when I actually saw a post where they were talking about games that they really enjoyed, it was stuff I had never heard of. So, of course, I went to go take a peek to see what they were. And it was all the same Euro-style, worker placement, bore-me-to-death kind of games.
Right. I know exactly what you're talking about, because after I do a review, I will go check out some of the other reviews to see what other people have said about stuff. And when I did my review of Venture Forth, I enjoyed the game, but I did find it a little tedious and boring after a while.
Yeah, so did I. So did I. We agreed on that.
And I went out and looked at the reviews, and all the reviews are like just glowing. Just, wow, this is the best game ever. Woo.
Compared to what?
You gotta be kidding me.
We're not trying to pick on Venture Forth. We're just using as an example.
Exactly. Right. Because it's a Euro theme format, and you and I are both not really big on Euro games. There's a lot of people who are, and yes, that's good for them.
I like a good Euro game.
Yeah.
I like a good Euro game.
I really enjoy Agricola. It's a fun game for me.
There are games out there that have Euro style mechanics that are actually a lot of fun and that bring something new to the table, or even if they're using the same tried and true mechanics, they're putting them together in a way that is different.
Yes, exactly.
That's not the case with most of the Euro games out there. Here's a perfect example. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to play Seven Wonders.
No, I've never had a chance to play Seven Wonders.
Okay. I've played it a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a drafting game.
Right.
It's a card draft game, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And when that came out, people were just going bananas about it. Oh my gosh, this is the greatest thing. And I'll be the first to say that, yes, you know what? I enjoyed it. Would it be something that I'd be all excited about? Not really, because you basically, every round is the same drafting mechanic. So when you start out the game, you don't know what cards you're going to end up with. You get to select from what's handed over to you after somebody else picks.
Okay.
But there's really no way for you to actually put together a strategy because you never know what's coming out. And that was one of the big knocks I had about the game. So anyway, Seven Wonders comes out. Everybody, they love it. They love it. They love it. It's awesome. Now, suddenly, Seven Wonders is, that was a failure. Really? It was a failure? All these people were talking about just what a great game it was. And now these are the same people saying, well, you know, just didn't do it. And another trip up for Asmodee. Seriously?
Yeah, that is definitely one of their most popular games.
Mm-hmm. It's sold really well. But just because something sells a lot of copies doesn't always necessarily mean it's a good game.
No, it doesn't. And don't get me wrong. We're in no way saying that every Euro game is a crappy game.
No, not at all. There are plenty of really good Euro games out there.
And anybody who wants to recommend to us a really good Euro game that we really need to try, feel free.
I think you really need to try Rowboat. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. You've already played that.
Right.
And I wouldn't consider that a Euro game either. So.
No, there's plenty of American games that we just don't enjoy either.
Yes. And we don't portray ourselves as some sort of so-called experts on gaming.
No. We know what we like and we talk about what we like and what we like about it and what we don't like about it. And I think in that effort of doing that, we're letting people know, okay, maybe we don't like it, but maybe they really enjoy that particular aspect of it. So maybe it would be a good game for them. So I'm not going to condemn a game, but we have condemned a few games.
A few, but not very many.
No, not very many.
Thing is that a lot of people probably don't realize, too, is a lot of times if we get a game that we really dislike, we just won't talk about it.
That's true. Especially with the small publishers, because we're not out totally destroy some small publisher because they're really making the effort to go out and get a game published because it's something that they believe in. And maybe there are a lot of people out there who would enjoy that particular game. We're just two guys.
And we don't get off on ripping into other people's designs and things like that. We're not here to focus on the negativity. I pride what we do, number one, our honesty. We pretty much tell you how we see it.
Yeah, you're right. There's good games, there's bad games, there's our opinion, and, you know, people make
their
own
choices.
Yeah,
and that's all it is. It's our opinions. That's all it is. Reviews, same thing.
Exactly.
It's just our opinions. So I say we move on to the news.
All right, let's go.
Good evening, Mr. Mrs. North and South America, and all the ships and clippers at sea. Let's go to France, Flash.
On February 14th, iLevel Entertainment will be launching a Kickstarter project in a bid to fund their newest release, which is Nature of the Beast, Prairie versus Polar. Now, Nature of the Beast is an award-winning, I'm not sure what the awards are, but it's one of them, strategy game featuring animal armies battling for control in a secret war in the shadows of humanity. As iLevel Entertainment's first release, Nature of the Beast earned high praise from game critics and players alike. I gotta admit, I don't know anything about
it. Do you have any signed affidavits to prove this?
I do, actually, from Ross Perot.
Is he still around?
I don't even know. I think he is.
So did everybody else when he was running for election.
Can I finish?
Yes, I was just asking. Would you like to send me copies of these reviews and these awards, please?
Now, Nature of the Beast features the same deep and diverse card mechanics pioneered by the original game, while upgrading the game experience. Included are reversible game boards, full color rule book, tokens. Yes, it's got to have tokens. And new cards to supplement the original four habitats. There's sufficient storage to keep up to six Nature of the Beast decks in the same box. The card features streamlined designs, and an entirely new card type is included, which is called the Trap. They have to say about it, they're excited to give their fans the game that they've been waiting for, along with some new perks that they didn't even see coming. Lead artist and co-designer Mark Anticole says, Kickstarter is a fantastic way for fans to financially support the new game and earn sweet incentives at the same time.
Well, sweet.
Yeah, I gotta admit, that is true.
Were they giving you candy?
I would like some candy.
You always want candy. And if candy's not available, Barbara's okay, right? Is that how that works?
Yeah, exactly.
Tell your wife.
The online campaign begins on February 14th, and we do hope to see lots of friends, old and new, along for the ride. So basically what they're saying is they're hoping to get the support for this game. I don't know a lot about their Nature of the Beast original game.
I was taking a peek at it a few days ago because I had heard the news as well.
Right.
And we're probably going to take a peek at the previous editions that had come out.
Yeah, which will be cool.
It does look like it's kind of tongue-in-cheek. It's got kind of a humorous feel to it. There's like squirrels and pigs and just all different stuff.
Uh-huh.
So it could be a lot of fun. It sort of looks like kind of a collectible card game where I can't legally use the actual word that the letters T-A-P spell.
Yes.
Unless I'm referring to Magic the Gathering. But I believe it's got some sort of a mechanic where you turn the card and it does whatever effect. It looks like it could be fun.
We will definitely know more about it.
It's not from Europe, so right there. Thank goodness.
Go ahead, ostracize that part of our...
We know the Eurogamers tune into us all the time.
They do. We've gotten emails from thousands. Okay, I'm okay, but we'll see.
Yeah, exactly.
If sufficiently funded, iLevel hopes to release Nature of the Beast Prairie versus Polar by third quarter of 2012.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. Privateer Press has announced details of the next expansion book and series of models for the Red Hot War Machine tabletop miniatures game. Titled War Machine Colossals, the new expansion features much larger models than the game has included to date, which would be pretty big because the Warjacks are pretty substantially sized. The expansion book is expected to release in July. The new Colossals range of miniatures will stand nearly twice as tall as the largest models currently included in the game. The new sculpts offer the same level of detail that Privateer Press has been known for, and these super heavy Warjacks are mounted on 120mm bases. War Machine Colossals embody the next big step for War Machine and Privateer Press, Privateer Director of Business Development William Schick said. Colossals are the culmination of everything we've learned over the last 10 years of making miniatures. Yeah, make bigger miniatures and you could charge people more money for them.
Could they really be called miniatures at that point?
Maxatures? I don't know.
Actual size.
Well, if memory serves me correctly, the Warjacks right now probably stand about 3 inches tall. So if these are going to be twice as large, we're talking 6-7 inches.
Nice. Imperial Walker size.
You're going to be busting out the airbrush to paint those. No, seriously. Thought I was joking.
Yeah, I know nothing.
Thought I was kidding. I know nothing.
I know nothing.
I see nothing.
We are on the moon.
But not for long. Anyway, each major faction in the game will have its own new colossal model, as well as new war casters representing the evolution of the game's iconic characters. New rules and gameplay options will be designed for large-scale games of 150 points or more.
Wow. Okay, so that's one of those games where you have a certain number of points and you buy your armies from them. And
yep, yeah. Cool. A lot of games are like
yes,
that.
Yes, yes.
Well, it's to even up the sides, really. I mean, it's to create game balance.
That's true. I think we could trace that all the way back to, like, Fletcher Brand.
Yeah, really. Mm-hmm. I think the system that really most people think of when they're thinking of points, two titles would jump to mind. One would be, of course,
Warhammer.
Games Workshop. Yeah, Warhammer 40K. But also, historical miniatures players would probably remember games like DRM, if I remember correctly. It was like an ancients system.
Mm-hmm.
You could take all these different ancient armies and fight against another ancient army, and it was all based on points. Points are huge when it comes to like tournaments.
Right. Well, because it gives that everybody way you can level playing ground, right?
Yeah, right. Well, outside of their skill as a commander and their loaded dice. I mean, their die rolling skills.
We got to get into one of those again, like at our next convention that we go to.
What, a loaded dice game?
No, one where you and I, like, command a force. Been a long time.
Interestingly enough, I have to talk to John Krantz from Consim World, who he also runs Consim World Expo in Tempe here in Arizona.
Okay.
I am thinking of running a Fletcher Pratt game a couple of,
at Consim World?
Of days.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah. Is that all right with you? I mean, you...
No, that ain't happening.
Okay, forget it. I'll run a Call of Cthulhu game.
Oh, come on!
It would be the only role-playing game going on at Consim World. Yes, actually, I have been thinking about that.
That'd be cool. Not bad at all.
I think so. I think it would be. I bet you I could probably get a couple of the guys from Victory Point Games in.
Yeah, that would be neat. Get Herman Luntman out there.
Oh, sure. John Welsh, yeah.
I'm doing an all call.
Yeah. The only thing would be putting the ships together.
Coming in mid-March from GMT is 1989. 1989 is an exciting, fast-paced game simulating the end of the Cold War in 1989. During this amazing year, a series of democratic revolutions ended the 40-year Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe. 1989 simulates the political, social, and economic aspects of these revolutions using a card-driven system similar to Twilight Struggle.
Woohoo!
Really love.
Yes, we do.
One player plays the communist. At the start of the game, he holds unquestioned power across the six nations of the Warsaw Pact.
Kind of like myself.
Like you do now, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there are ominous clouds on the horizon. The new leader in Moscow has declared no more will Soviet tanks prop up tottering communist governments. The economies, after decades of central planning and stagnation, have reached various stages of crisis. Inside the churches and among the students and their professors, there are dissident movements that have been emboldened. The communist player will have to use a variety of strategies in order to hold on to its empire. The other player plays the Democrat. At the dawn of 1989, behind the Iron Curtain, no one considers revolution possible. The goal of dissidents is to create a civil society outside the control of the communist regimes. On their side are students who are fascinated with the style and pop culture of the West and the church. Against them is the vast apparatus of the communist state. Their challenge is to provide the workers, who are the bulk of society, to join their cause. Actually, this sounds like a pretty good game.
I have heard some really good things about 1989 so far.
Now, hasn't this been in evolution for a while now?
It has. It was on GMT's P500, and it reached its goal. It's well past its goal. It wasn't on there all that long. Jason Matthews is one of the designers of this. He is also one of the designers of Twilight Struggle.
Excellent.
And I've been hearing, ready for this? Hold on to your hat. I am hearing rumblings that it is a better game than Twilight Struggle.
What?
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing. Yeah, that it doesn't have, you know how early on it's the Soviets have the advantage, later on the U.S. has the advantage. You can fool around and push that DEFCON up to try to make the other player lose the game. It doesn't have any of that. So it's supposed to be very, very balanced, and it's supposed to be really, really good.
I'm definitely looking forward to this one.
I have heard some things from playtesters saying that it is actually better than Twilight Struggle. I'm looking forward to that one. Mid-March. Not that long away. Mid-March. Ooh, yeah.
Gosh.
Days of Wonder has added multiplayer functionality to its Ticket to Ride Pocket version for small iOS devices, such as the iPhone or the iPod Touch. Players who are using the $1.99 app will now be able to play against up to four friends online. It also allows players to switch screens to other games or apps without losing progress on the game. Also, this new update will allow people who play via Bluetooth to have an improved experience. The iPad version was updated simultaneously with the new Pocket release to ensure compatibility with the new Bluetooth software. The first version of Ticket to Ride Pocket was released last fall, and the online version launched in 2004. Here's something very interesting. I don't know if it's true, but I have heard this. There are actually over 15 million people who are registered to play Ticket to Ride online.
Really?
That's what I've heard. I don't know if it's a fact or not, but that is a huge number of people playing Ticket to Ride online.
I got to admit, I've played it online. It's a pretty fun game.
I didn't even think that 15 million, because you know how Days of Wonder gives you that free code when you buy a game to play the online version of it?
Yeah.
Is there a way for people to play Ticket to Ride online without buying the actual game?
Well, yeah, I'm pretty sure you can just buy it.
Okay. Well, I didn't know. I wasn't sure. You know what? There's a Euro game that I don't hate.
You don't particularly enjoy it, though.
No, I thought it was all right. When we played it before, I thought it was an okay game.
Yeah. It's definitely one of the consummate gateway games.
Yes, most definitely, yeah.
You know, along with, like, Carcassonne.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good game. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Toss it out, kiddingly. But that's a Euro that I don't have issues with.
Mm-hmm. More and more games are being released as dice versions of themselves.
Are they? Really?
It's true.
Like what?
One of the newest, well, let me tell you about
it. I'm asking.
The newest games to join the list are Uno Dice Edition and Apples to Apples, the dice game.
Yeah, which we know our listeners are huge fans of both of those games.
They are. The Uno Dice game comes in what looks like a soda can. The game is described as an exciting new twist on the classic card game, which, of course, pretty much everybody's played Uno. Uno meets speed in this fast, fun, different way to play. Players start with 5 dice, but must take another die and roll if they can't play their turn. To win, you have to match colors and numbers and be the first player to get rid of all of your dice. Uno Dice includes 11 dice and instructions, and is for 2 players with an MSRP of $9.99. The Apples to Apples dice game is the newest way to play Apples to Apples. I gotta admit, I couldn't see how you could play Apples to Apples as a dice game, but...
I can't see how you would play Uno as a dice game, and especially playing Uno as a 2-player game. You might as well play Go Fish.
One die out. Uno!
Yep, it's a solitaire game.
Right. The Apples to Apples dice game also comes in a soda can and lets you create your own hilarious comparisons with a roll of the dice. The judge rolls the green die first to declare an adjective that starts with the resulting letter. Then the judge rolls the red die, and the players race to choose one and say a noun that starts with the letter on the selected die. The judge awards a chip to the noun he or she deems the best comparison. The first player to earn 5 chips wins. It includes 1 20-sided green die, 6 6-sided red die, and 25 green apple chips with instructions for $9.99.
Wouldn't that be red dice?
Yeah, it would be. But that's not what they said. There's also going to be a Phase 10 and a Skip-Bo dice game.
Skip-Bo!
Yeah, I gotta admit, I've played Phase 10 and I hated
it. I know.
Hated Phase
10. I've heard from other people the same thing.
And all of these games are being published from Mattel.
Just quick side note.
Yeah.
Press release, they use the word hilarious. I find it kind of funny how often people use that word. You should check out the comedy special that Louis C.K. did, and it's called Hilarious. And he talks about how people misuse that word all the
really?
Time. Yeah. If something's just funny, it's not hilarious. Hilarious is supposed to be something that is just mind-blowingly hysterical.
Right, like that episode of...
The IT Crowd. Show. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes,
that one was
you
hilarious.
Said that,
the
yes.
Others were funny, but that one was hilarious.
Yes, but I just thought I'd toss that out there. Louis C.K. sent me a few bucks, so I thought I'd throw his name out.
That's sweet. Cool.
Margaret Weiss Productions is bringing Marvel Heroic Role-Playing Basic Game to the public on February 28th. The basic rulebook will include everything needed to play the game. The new rule system was developed by Cam Banks, but includes input from such well-known game developers as Rob Donahue, Matt Forbeck, Will Hindmarch, Philippe Antoine Menard, and Jesse Scobel. The initial background for the system centers on the breakout story arc described in the New Avengers issues 1-6 by Brian Michael Bendis, David Finch, and Danny Mickey. Game statistics for many popular Marvel characters are also included in the basic game book, including Captain America, Spider-Man, Daredevil, Iron Man, and Wolverine, as well as numerous Marvel supervillains. The game system is designed to be easy to learn, acting as an entry-level game for fans of superhero comics while offering enough complexity to satisfy experienced players. It's based on the proven Cortex Plus system that's been featured in other licensed Margaret Weiss production titles, including Smallville and Leverage. The Marvel Heroic role-playing basic game is going to be available as a softcover book with the suggested retail price of $19.99. The game will be available only in the US and Canada. Future releases will tie the role-playing game to ongoing themes in Marvel's comics. These releases, called events, will include event books and event supplements for introducing new characters and expanding gameplay. Three events are planned for 2012. Civil War in March, Annihilation in June, and Age of Apocalypse in September. Event supplements will be published as softcover books, once again with the suggested retail price of $19.99. Special case-bound essential editions will also be available for the events, with the suggested retail price of $29.99, as well as full-color hardcover premium editions priced at $39.99.
You know, I kept trying to play the Moonlight character, but the moon? He kept getting canceled after 12 episodes, 12 moon, adventures.
Moonlight character?
Moonlight.
Are you talking about Moon Knight?
Moon Knight, yes.
You were trying to play David Addison?
Or Bruce Willis to the rest of them.
Yeah, exactly, right. Wasn't that his character's name, though? David Addison or something?
You're right. It was. It was David Addison. I can't remember what's her name's character.
Maddie something or other.
Oh, my God. Where do you pull this stuff out of?
Remember, we used to play Trivial Pursuit, and people be like, you guys cheat. You guys read all these cards. It's like, how could we? You own the game. We don't.
Right.
We didn't drug you one night and then go off and read all the cards.
Quick, read all those cards, Jeff.
Okay, you read the question. I'll give you the answer. You tell me if I'm right. Okay. All right, your turn. I don't know. Just some weird things stick in my head.
I guess so.
As far as the Marvel role-playing game, it was funny because TSR and Mayfair Games both had superhero role-playing games. TSR had Marvel and Mayfair had DC. And out of the two, the Mayfair role-playing game was actually better. The TSR game kind of blew.
Yeah.
And both companies lost their licenses within months of each other to continue doing the superhero role-playing games.
Oh, okay, geez.
I don't know anything about Margaret Weiss Productions. Personally, I had never heard of the company before, but they do have quite a few different licensed role-playing games. Like I mentioned, one is Smallville.
Yeah.
And I don't know anything about the system or anything like that. One thing I do think sounds pretty interesting is these event books that'll come out.
Like Civil War.
Yeah. Age of Apocalypse, that's X-Men. Annihilation, offhand, I don't know what that would be. Sorry, I don't follow mainstream comics as much as I once did.
Right, yeah, neither do I.
That should be pretty interesting to check out.
Yeah, definitely.
Because I know
to play Spidey.
Yeah, Captain America, baby. Or create your own superhero, I would hope.
Dungeon Run is finally available at your local retailer.
Finally.
Games.
Wasn't this coming out last year?
Yes, it was. Tell you the truth, I don't know why. I know it has just popped up like within the past couple of days, finally.
I know. I remember a couple of weeks, gosh, maybe even more than a couple of weeks, I had posted a news piece that it was shipping to stores.
Well, you know, they took the long boat, basically.
They walked them.
They walked them there.
They walked the boxes in.
Dungeon Run is an exciting dash through a dungeon packed with monsters and traps. Each player controls a unique hero capable of great feats and whose powers and abilities are upgradable and customizable throughout the game.
Just like yourself.
I am upgradable right now.
That's
actually
right.
Players can work together to overcome the perils of the dungeon, or they can betray and sabotage each other as they see fit. Because
I'm liking that.
Yes, I figured you would.
You know, I only pretend to play like that. You know that.
Right. I know that actually when you're crushing me, you're really thinking, you know, I'm not really crushing him. I'm just crushing his spirit.
Not physically crushing you.
Exactly.
Yeah, like when was the last time I actually crushed you in a game?
Yeah, I know. I know. I'm just
because it's so easy to play stuff 1,800 miles apart.
Right. Exactly. Because in the final room of the dungeon lurks a powerful boss with the ultimate treasure, a treasure that turns its owner into the most powerful warrior they can become. Slay the boss.
The Highlander?
Steal the treasure. The Highlander!
There can be only one!
In the end, there can be only one. Then run for your life as your friends try to cut you down.
They're not my friends then.
Hey, buddy, come back here.
Let me kill you.
In Dungeon Run, only one hero can escape with a fabled summoning stone. Summoning stone. Don't walk, run. It's a new game each time you play. Dungeon Run features a randomly assembled dungeon that changes each time you play, as do the monsters you face and the treasures you find. 8 different heroes, each with unique options for customization, further add to a wealth of gameplay options. Choose the vicious Tundra Orc and bash your way through everything that stands in your path. Play as the cunning Grounder Wizard and use... Like Groundhog Wizard?
That's what popped in my head. Damn, I saw my shadow. I won't be able to practice magic for another six weeks.
And use your magic to cheat the laws of nature. Select the Guild Dwarf Adventurer and lay traps to ensnare your friends. Wouldn't that be like a rogue? Why does it have to be a dwarf?
And why would you do that to your friends?
There are many paths to victory in Dungeon Run. Win by working with your friends or against them. Just win. Dungeon Run is a game for 1 to 6 players and is available now at an MSRP of $49.95.
Is it really available now?
Well, that's what they tell me.
I'll take a guess. It was probably delayed because of the figures.
You think so?
That would be my guess, yeah.
Well, you know, that stuff happens.
Well, sure. And I don't think that Plaid Hat Games has released a game with miniatures before.
No, so we better check that one out, see how they are.
We'll have to take a peek.
I wonder if they're primed.
Don't even go there. Sorry. Those Dust Tactics miniatures are not pre-primed. I don't care what anybody says. Actually, speaking of miniatures, Ganesha Games announces the release of Drums and Shakos Large Battles, miniature rules for large Napoleonic battles. Each player controls a division of 2 or 3 brigades. Designed to be played in less than 3 hours, its mechanics force participants to make tactical choices. Drums and Shakos Large Battles rewards good management of reserves, right deployment of artillery, and historical use of cavalry. Maneuver your battalions and regiments, react to your opponent's actions, and launch the final attack at the right moment. Victory lies only a few steps away. It includes innovative mechanics that detail the approach and contact phases of combat, an easy measuring system, very limited use of counters and markers, and no bookkeeping. There are clear victory conditions based on losses and penetration into enemy territory. Yes! The rules allow for reactions in the opponent's turn. No player is ever truly inactive. There are 4 scenarios included, and there's an appendix for playing at the core or army level. It's playable in any scale from 6 to 28 millimeters, and divisional army lists are also included for the major powers, Austria, France, Britain, Prussia, Russia, and Spain. And there's also simple guidelines to refighting historical battles. I thought that was kind of interesting because you don't run across a whole lot of Napoleonic's miniature systems that you could tackle a large battle in 3 hours or less. Oh, so I'd like to see how they pull that one off. Although it does sound like the system is built on a regimental level or a battalion level as opposed to corps or armies. So maybe that 3 hour time frame goes right out the window if you start playing on the corps or army level.
Yeah.
Do you remember back years ago, we were at someone's house? It wasn't somebody that we normally gamed with, but we went to their house and it was Napoleonic's war game. And I believe they were using the Empire rule system that was available from the Emperor's headquarters that was in Chicago at the time. They're long gone. And I think we were there about 6 hours and nothing went on in this game. And it was just the most mind-numbingly dull miniatures game I think I ever had the misfortune to take part in.
An earmark of the 70s and 80s.
I don't know. There were a lot of miniatures games that were pretty damn good that we would play. And this certainly was not one of them. And I was looking to get into Napoleonic's. This is even years later. And I did pick up the Empire rules because so many people were like, this is the Napoleonic's rule set. I would have never, ever considered even attempting to play those rules.
Really?
Yeah, if you wanted to spend 3 weeks playing the Battle of Waterloo. I mean, nothing happened.
Actual length battles.
What are you talking about? Waterloo was like 3 days. Well, the actual battle was 1 day.
And 3 weeks to play it.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. It was just terrible.
Yeah, I think I do vaguely remember what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. And the miniatures were really crap painted. They were like 15 millimeters. So, and then the terrain looked awful. Yeah, I was just,
As a proud new owner of the non-Kindle Fire version of the Amazon Kindle.
So what is the non-Kindle?
Kindle Fire.
So you have a Kindle, but it's a non-Fire.
Yes. You know, okay. The fire is the new snazzy color version.
I don't know. I have a very nice $400 Android tablet.
Yes, so. Well, I don't have that. I have an Amazon Kindle.
I'm just saying.
So I went out looking for any games that I could find for the Kindle.
Lots of luck.
Well, what I discovered was a new incarnation of the classic choose your own adventure style of books. Do you remember the choose your own adventures that were popular way back when?
I remember them. I really didn't get into them much. If I remember correctly, you had a bunch of them.
I did. I did have a whole bunch of them. And I enjoyed them. Flip to this page.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I remember.
You pick a choice. You flip to another page. Well, you got to admit the Amazon Kindle and probably the Nook 2. Yeah. I'm not going to, just push the Kindle, is primarily built to do one of these type of adventures because they could easily go to all kinds of different locations just by...
Right, yeah, jump back and forth to different pages and that.
So I picked up this game called Choice of Broadsides. It cost me 99 cents. I'm sure you know I'm a big fan of the Patrick O'Brien series.
Well, I know that. The listeners wouldn't know that, yes. The Aubrey Martin...
Aubrey Maturin...
Oh, Maturin. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
See, obviously, I'm not a big fan.
It's actually a little unusual for me because there's a whole lot of 18th century sailing jargon there and a lot of information about stuff that I would normally have no idea about. And when I first started reading them, I had no idea what was going on. And then I slowly got into these books and they were really, really good books.
So what does Shiver Me Timbers mean?
Shiver Me Timbers?
I'm joking. Isn't that like a nautical term? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. It's a pirate term.
So I picked up this Choose Your Own Adventure book, basically, for 99 cents. It's from Choice of Games. They put out a couple of other adventures called Choice of Vampires, and then there's a fantasy one. I think it's Choice of Fantasy or something like that. So Choice of Broadsides places you in the role of a new midshipman and launches you on a naval career during the age of wooden ships and iron men. In this fictional land...
Hey, time out. That is copyright Avalon Hill. I don't believe you can actually say that.
It's the name of a game, yes, but I believe it describes a certain age, too.
Okay.
I don't think they can copyright an age.
I'm just saying, for legal reasons, I had nothing to do with you saying that.
Right. Well, men are the dominant species on the Earth.
So. Hey!
It's in this fictional land with the Albions versus the Gauls, which I don't know why they just didn't use England and France.
Yeah.
Because it's not like you can copyright the names of the countries.
Right. Oh, sorry. We involved ourselves in copyright infringement by saying Britain.
Now, the unique thing about these things is that you can actually build up stats because at the beginning of the game, it starts off with a little narrative and stuff is going on. You make one decision and then they say, hold on, let's find a little bit more about yourself. And they ask you this series of questions and this builds like your stats.
Right,
for the game.
You're creating your character.
Mm-hmm. And you actually build a character with 15 different statistics. It doesn't take all that long to go through.
There's been plenty of computer role-playing games that presented you with those kind of options of creating a character where you were actually answering a question as opposed to handing points out to a specific stat.
Yes, exactly. And it's similar to that. Mm-hmm. But of course, it's novel, but you get to choose your own kind of path, which is pretty cool. Since I've always been interested in this period and the nautical history, I picked it up. It was 99 cents, So
sure,
it's no big deal. And I went through this game, and I'm not going to do any real spoilers or anything for anybody who's actually interested in it. But you start your career as a midshipman, and you move all the way through becoming a post-captain.
Oh, you ruined it for me now.
And I gotta admit, then it abruptly cuts off and gives you your final stats, and then it's over. It took me about a half hour to go through it, but it is really well written. Yes, it took about a half hour to go through. But I've gone through it at least a half a dozen times now, and I'm still finding if I had made different decisions, this is what would have really happened.
So what would have happened if you didn't kill off your entire crew for mutiny?
Mutiny! I actually had to go through two mutinies.
There you go!
Which was pretty rough, but it is definitely pulled from the Patrick O'Brien series of novels. It's not from Horatio Hornblower. No, it's got even some of the surnames. You get to pick your own name, and they give you a list of suggestions. options, but then you can also just type in your name if you wanted to, which is cool. You can concentrate on gunnery. You can concentrate on sailing. You can concentrate on leadership.
Which, no doubt, you had two mutinies, so that wasn't what you concentrated on.
I remember playing one game where, okay, we're at war. I meet this one guy in combat on our ships, and I end up capturing him.
Hey, you're spoiling it. Stop.
No, I'm not spoiling it. Don't worry. There's so many different paths that can happen.
There can't be that many because it took you a half hour to play through it.
Yes, but I haven't explored them all yet, to tell you the truth. But this one particular guy, you're at, you either end up doing something like killing him, you end up becoming friends with him, you end up becoming his lover.
You knew that was coming. The love that could not speak its name.
I remember fighting one time, and in my fight skill, I hadn't pumped it up as high this time. The guy ends up cutting off my hand. I'm like, what? Wait a minute.
And then you became friends.
Right. Of course, I couldn't shake hands with him, but still.
Well, you could use the other one.
I thought it was really well written. I did think it was a little short. I mean, a half hour, it kind of cuts you off there.
Well, it's 99 cents. Though.
Still, yeah, exactly. 99 cents. And I had a really good time playing through it. It's definitely a huge step up from the old Choose Your Own Adventure books, where you could page back and then look at, okay, what if I had made this decision?
Right. Yeah, yes. And everybody would do that. Let's be honest.
Exactly. In this one, you can't really do that.
But can you die in this?
Yes, I mean, you can die.
Because I was going to say, because that was something that would happen a lot with the Choose Your Own Adventure books, too.
Right. The snake swallows you whole and you're dead.
Well, if you remember, they also had, and this was from Steve Jackson Games when they actually made games, they had...
sorry. Little aside there.
Well, I'm just saying. They had the magic trip, you know, melee and wizard and stuff like that. And they would have those adventures where it was the same kind of thing. It was you choose your own adventure. And then you would have to play out the combats.
Okay.
So you had different stats and things like that. One of these days, I got to jump on eBay and pick up some of that stuff. Because I've got tons, well, not tons. I've got quite a few older games that I owned. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, just like you, we had these games. And then somehow along the way of our lives, they have disappeared.
Yes, exactly.
Personally, I think they've been stolen from me, but that's just my opinion.
By gnomes.
I was going to say that, too. That's exactly what I was going to say. I think a little gnome came in the middle of the night and ripped me off. I should look to try to pick those up. And I'm sure they would probably run me, I think they were like $2.95 or $3.95 at the time.
Yeah.
They would probably run me about $25 each now.
Right.
Maybe I should swing over to Noble Knight and see if they carry them. Because I've purchased some out of print stuff from them before and really, really surprised by the condition of it. When it was like, you know, it said very good or something like that. I got it and I thought to myself, seriously? I mean, this is almost mint.
I got to admit, these are definitely a step up from the old Choose Your Own Adventure books, because there's multiple choices that you can make and your statistics are affected by the choices that you do make.
Sure.
At the end, you get to see all your final ratings and you get to know how far you actually advanced in your military career. Mm-hmm. And it was really cool. And I can see that the next step would probably be to add some randomization into it so that going to a battle, it becomes a random die roll within the game itself.
Sure.
Right. And so I'm looking for that next generation of games.
Here's a quick question. You said it's more along the line of the Patrick O'Brien books, but not Horatio Hornblower. What did you mean by that?
Some of the adventures in the story itself, I feel, were amalgams.
Were lifted, inspired by.
Inspired by stuff that I read in the Patrick O'Brien books. Now, I've only read like two or three of the Horatio Hornblower, and I haven't finished them yet. They're good, but I didn't think they were good as the Patrick O'Brien books.
Huh.
But some of them, you know, you go on a cutting out expedition, and it's just very cool, especially if you like the nautical theme from the 1800s. Big recommendation from me. Choice of broadsides.
I have one last news story, and I think this will bring just a smile to everyone's face. How does a gamer propose to a girlfriend? Does he simply buy a ring? Does he wine and dine his love before getting down on one knee and asking her the question? Or does he get the creators of one of his favorite board games to create a card that's unique to the situation, using that card to propose to the one he loves in the middle of playing their favorite game? Well, if your name is Alan Girding, then the last choice is the only way to go. Alan contacted Justin Gary at Gary Games, makers of Ascension, Chronicle of the Godslayer, to see if the deck-building game designers could help him set up a marriage proposal that his girlfriend, Crystal Shelton, would never forget. The folks at Gary Games helped Alan set up a plan where he could propose to Crystal during a game of Storm of Souls. At the time, they were at a point where they were about to go to print with some more promotional cards. So Gary Games decided to also print a special card that would give Alan a chance to pop the question in-game. The card frame was customized for them, and it's a one-of-a-kind card. But did she say yes?
Well,
you'll have to check out the video that's out there to take a peek. Oh, what, you want me to blow it? You want me to ruin it for everybody?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, she said yes.
Okay, good.
Here's the funny thing. Obviously, he set up a camera kind of hidden to film them playing the game. They're playing the game for about a minute or so before she gets to this card.
Okay.
And it is just so stereotypical of the guy and the girl playing a game. He's kind of running the show of it. You know what I mean? And I found that kind of funny and sort of revealing. But yes, she does say yes. She flips out. And it's funny, he busts out the ring on her. And she's more excited about the card in the game than the diamond ring.
That's really cool, though.
It is. And now the Ring of Gerd is a new Game Day promo from Gary Games. The special promo is available during the Game Day events that will be taking place in local stores throughout the month of February. By marrying a faction with Lifebound, you can reliably get one rune per turn. For Storm of Souls fans, this makes it easier to hit those powerful Unite effects like Lionheart and Granger as well. So a big congratulations to Alan Girding and Crystal Shelton. All the best.
And now it's time for the Gaming Gang's game review. Try saying that 10 times fast.
I'm not going to try.
My first review is on Consensus the Movie Edition from MindLogic Inc. It's from 2009, and it's for 3 to 8 players, ages 17 and up. And I think the reason it says 17 and up is because it does help to have a little knowledge of movies. It's got movies in it ranging from 1940-something up till the current time.
Okay.
So most people under 17 couldn't care less about movies from the earlier periods.
I know people in their 30s who tell me that they won't watch a movie that's in black and white because they're boring.
That's crazy because there's so many really good black and white movies.
Dude, my favorite movies of all time are black and white.
Yeah, it's true.
Casablanca, Citizen Kane, I go back and forth which one is my top. Neither one of those is in color.
It's very true. For me, it would be Scared Stiff, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis.
Are you serious? There's no, yeah, I was going to say, there's no way you're serious about that.
No.
Oh, no. My favorite movie is X, The Man with the X-Ray Eyes. Actually, I think that was in color. Now that I think about it. No, my all-time favorite movie is Star Wars Episode I.
Well, I got to admit, I could almost quote 90% of that movie verbatim.
Unfortunately.
Yes.
I walked out of the theater after that one. I was just, George.
What the hell are you talking about?
Episode
I. Are you harping on Star Wars? Oh, Episode I.
Yes. Okay. Episode
I. You're not talking
one.
New Hope.
No. That's
sorry.
Episode 4.
Right.
Get with the whole numbering situation here, man.
Which, of course, back then when we saw Episode 4, we're like, what?
Yeah, exactly. I walked out of the theater. I went and saw it with my friend Mike, and he was like, yeah, that wasn't too bad. And I was like, dude, that was horrible. That was terrible. I thought to myself, was that a Star Wars movie or was that just some knockoff of Star Wars?
Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Sorry, that's back to New Hope.
That's okay, because that was a good movie.
Yes. Consensus Movie Edition is a party game for those who love movies. The nice thing about it is that you don't need to have seen all the movies to play the game, as it's not a trivia game. A basic familiarity with many movies is all the preparation that you need. As with most party games, you get a slew of cards. Mm-hmm. There's 200 different movies represented by the cards, ranging from Casablanca, and of course, Citizen Kane's in there too.
It better be.
To Wedding Crashers.
Okay.
The consummate movie of 2005.
It was all right. I thought it was funny.
Yeah. The newest movie in my edition is Sex and the City from 2008, and I'm not sure if it's been updated since then. Each of the movie cards lists the name, the year it came out, and the stars of the movie, which is kind of nice. Also included is a stack of 75 question cards. A question could be, which of the movies is best described as timeless? Or, in which of the movies does sex play the most prominent role? The board itself is long and narrow and has spots for 10 different movie cards, and you deal out 10 movie cards to fill those spots. You place the remaining cards in a stack near the board. You place the question cards in a stack, and each player selects a pawn and receives a set of voting cards, which are just cards that are numbered from 1 to 10 that match the color of your pawn. All the players place their pawns on the starting space on the score track on the board. There's only 11 spaces, so the games are actually fairly short. A question is selected, and each player secretly selects a voting card with a number matching the movie that they think best fits the question. Each movie space on the board has a number, so you always know which movie goes with what number. After everyone has voted, the cards are flipped over and matched to the movies. If there is a consensus with a clear majority, then those players get to advance their token. However, if all the players select the same movie, then nobody gets to advance.
Wouldn't that be the consensus vote then?
Yeah, everybody advances. What really do you gain? Nothing. So they took that option out.
Okay, I see that.
There are clear examples in the instructions, but in a nutshell, the movie that has at least one more vote than all of the other movies
is the consensus choice.
But not all the votes is the consensus choice and allows the players voting for it to advance.
Okay.
So in this way, knowing more about the other players and what they might select is more valuable than actually being familiar with all the movies on the board.
Okay.
All of the movies voted on are removed and replaced with fresh movies.
So then you only play through a certain set of movies once per game?
Yeah, within that game. Yeah, there's 200 different movie cards. You won't go through that in one game.
Right, you won't go through 20 rounds.
Because movies that don't get picked, those cards don't get replaced. They just stay on the board.
Oh, okay, all right.
All of the movies voted on are removed and replaced with fresh movies, and another player selects and reads the next question. The first player to reach the finish space wins the game. We've had a lot of fun playing consensus. It's more popular with the adult crowd, those that have had the opportunity to watch many movies over the years.
Mm-hmm.
The kids and the teens didn't really get into it exactly because of this reason.
Well, they're not familiar with a lot of the movies that are there.
Right. But the adults love seeing the movie names that would pop up.
Mm-hmm.
However, once you've worked your way through the movie cards and they start repeating, then it's time to pull out another party game and put this one away until the next party. It's a game that will lose its appeal the more you play and will become dated as time passes. But for the price point it has and the amount of fun that we receive from the game, it's well worth it, really.
What was the price point?
It's $25.
Okay.
So if you enjoy party games like Crappy Birthday or Wits and Wagers.
Crappy Birthday.
Then you should really enjoy playing Consensus Movie Edition. There's also Regular Consensus and Consensus Music Edition as well.
What is Regular Consensus?
Well, without movies, it's just regular questions.
Thank you.
Based on
yes,
things.
I figured that.
One final note, MindLogic included a sheet listing every movie that appears in the game. They call it the Movies to Rent or Buy checklist.
Uh-huh.
And I think that was actually a nice little touch. I know this was a short review, but it's a party game. They're always short.
Wasn't short enough, man.
I think you would actually enjoy
it. It does sound like something I would probably get a kick out of.
Yes, exactly. So, good game.
Nice. My first review is Lock and Load, Forgotten Heroes Vietnam, 2nd Edition. Sticking with the theme of party games.
Right. The title's longer than my whole review.
Right there. Obviously, it's from Lock and Load Games, designed by Mark H. Walker and released in late 2011. It's for two players. Playing time is 60 minutes and up, and it retails for $59.99. Lock and Load Forgotten Heroes Vietnam, or what I will refer to as FHV, is a squad-level tactical war game where each player takes on the role of either the United States and her South Vietnamese allies, or the Communist Vietnamese forces that slugged it out from the mid to late 1960s. The game's 13 scenarios tackle a wide range of engagements, from small-scale firefights to all-out pitched battles with armor elements. Each turn represents 2 to 5 minutes of real time, while each hex is scaled to represent an area 50 meters wide. The game uses hero cards for each side, and this adds some personality to the fighting forces involved. The game also includes 5 geomorphic maps, 340 counters, a player aid chart, 13 scenario cards, 16 hero skill cards, a 35-page rulebook, a special handout card that has specific rules for Forgotten Heroes Vietnam, and a couple of six-sided dice. Opening the rulebook, FHV may look like a daunting game, but the reality is the main rulebook covers the 3.1 version of the lock and load rules, which are utilized in all of the lock and load series. This is a new twist to the presentation of lock and load games, as this allows for a single rulebook to be published and any particular rules inherent to that specific title are included on a separate reference card. The rules themselves are, for the most part, easily understood and written in an almost conversational style. The rules are presented in a way for you to read through enough of the book to get started on the first scenario and then move on from there. As players progress, additional rules such as helicopters, vehicles, fortifications, and so forth are added. The rules also include quite a few examples of play, and the last 5 pages of the book are dedicated to an extended example of play for you. One item to note is the line of sight rules can be a bit tricky to get the grasp of in the beginning, and overall they're a little bit fiddly. Each game breaks down into 3 phases: rally, operations, and administration. In the rally phase, both players roll to see who has initiative for the turn. Once that initiative is determined, each player then attempts to rally shaken troops. Some units may self-rally, but for the most part, most of the units only rally if a leader, hero, or medic is in the same hex. Troops can be shaken fairly easily and tend to become rather vulnerable in that condition, especially in hand-to-hand combat. So how well your troops rally can really be a make-or-break situation. To rally, the unit rolls 2 six-sided dice, adding leadership and terrain modifiers, and if the total is equal to or less than the unit's morale rating, they rally and they're no longer shaken. The operations phase is where the majority of the gameplay takes place, as each player takes turns activating and taking actions during a subphase known as an impulse. The player who won initiative can activate any one stack of units, but if a leader is activated, then any stack adjacent to him are activated as well. In this way, multiple stacks can take actions during the same impulse. These units then normally perform only one of several possible actions: spot for artillery, call in artillery fire, move, fire, assault move, or engage in hand-to-hand combat. After an activated stack has completed its actions, a marker is placed on the stack to indicate the actions taken, and then the opposing player may activate a leader or single stack. At times, there may be a chance for opportunity fire during your opponent's impulse as well. FHV handles fire combat much differently than most war game systems. You begin by taking the attacker's firepower points in the attacking stack, though only one squad gets the fire at full firepower. Other units' firepower is halved, but heroes do receive full firepower to add. You then add this to a single six-sided die roll. Modifiers for leadership, terrain, and target movement are then applied, resulting in an attack number. The defender then rolls a single die and adds any terrain modifiers for the hex it occupies. If the attacker's number is higher than the defender must make a damage check. The defender makes his check by rolling a single die and adding the difference between the previous die roll along with modifiers for leadership. If this new number is higher than the defender's morale rating, the direct fire table is consulted, which shows how much damage the defenders receive. The defender can be shaken, take casualties, or eliminated outright. Heroes, on the other hand, can be shaken, wounded, and eliminated. This goes for other individual character counters as well. takes a little getting used to, but after a few combats, the fire combat rules come pretty naturally. The rules covering helicopters, tanks, and artillery are a little more complex than the standard fire combat, but stem from that same basic resolution. Players continue trading impulses until all units have taken actions or three consecutive impulses have been passed. Player may choose to pass rather than activate troops. Since each player is only taking actions with one stack, or a group of troops with a leader activation, impulses move quickly enough with very little downtime. As each player looks for ways to react to his opponent while keeping an eye peeled for opportunity fire, both players are constantly engaged. Then there's the operations phase. This is non-combat movement, and unit markers are removed or changed to reflect a new status. Then it's time to move on to the next turn. FHV has a lot of quick action, and most games break down into a punch-counter-punch as each side looks to quickly take advantage of even the smallest opportunity to snatch victory from their opponent. One great aspect of FHV is the flavor it provides as far as simulating combat in Vietnam, as each of the different forces are modeled a bit differently. The Viet Cong don't have a lot of firepower, but have a nasty habit of fading away into the jungle. This is reflected by having to roll to spot VC units even if they were previously spotted, but they haven't fired or moved. Spotting is actually a critical part of FHV, as you can't shoot at someone if you can't see them. VC can also unleash devastating ambushes as well. U.S. Marines actually have their morale increase when shaken and can perform assault moves. North Vietnamese Army troops can engage in hand-to-hand combat and use the jungle very effectively. Regular U.S. Army troops don't receive any special benefits, but at least they're not the poorly trained and led ARVN units. Another interesting aspect of FHV is the inclusion of heroes. What makes it interesting is the fact that you don't start the scenarios with them, but each time a unit rolls a 1 on the damage check, that unit receives a random hero. Not only does the hero receive a skill card, 16 in all, but is actually a very tough character capable of adding bonuses in melee, rallying troops in the same hex, handling support weapons single-handedly, and never becoming shaken. Funny enough, one of the characters is Roland, the Thompson machine gunner, but he does have his head. I'm not sure how many people are going to actually catch that reference. Anyway, these heroes reflect the sudden display of heroism under fire that fighting men throughout history have displayed. You just never know what you're going to get until the you-know-what hits the fan. Of course, those ARVN troops have a much lower chance of producing a hero than the other combatants.
Yeah.
Because they suck. One aspect of FHV I wasn't overly keen on is the inclusion of random events, or what are considered to be random events that really aren't. I do understand the underlying design decision of creating an overall narrative to each scenario, but many of them include event markers that are placed on the map. The scenario card contains information about units, maps used, and so forth, but many of them also include a section that states, "Please don't read ahead. Stop. Do not read these paragraphs until instructed to do so by the scenario." What follows are a few paragraphs that indicate anything from a booby trap detonating to reinforcements arriving. The problem is that outside of a few paragraphs that ask you to roll a die, the event marker is going to be the same thing every time you play the scenario. This, to me, is not a random event. I think the scenarios would be better served if they had a list of random events that could take place dependent on a die roll, or possibly counters representing random events to be pulled blindly to indicate if an event occurs or, maybe more importantly, does not occur. Personally, I find the mostly scripted events lower the replayability of the scenarios, as you already know what's coming. All in all, Forgotten Heroes Vietnam is an excellent game. There's a lot to it, but once you've played through a few turns, you can easily get the hang of it. I feel the game models small-scale actions in Vietnam extremely well, and outside of a minor quibble here and there, it's certainly worthy of a place on the gaming shelf of any wargamer, and even those new to the genre with an interest in Vietnam.
Well, I gotta admit, the description of the fire seemed a little complex to me.
It is. It's different. It's a little out there, but I have run across a few of the lock and load games, and a lot of times their combat resolution is a little bit different. It's not simply here's one die roll and so forth. In fact, my next review is another game that kind of steps outside of what is the norm as far as combat resolution as well.
Mm.
One thing that I thought was sort of interesting is back when you and I first started really getting into gaming and playing board games and war games and things like that,
yeah.
Vietnam was really not a subject that was tackled very often.
No, it was probably a little too fresh.
Well, yeah, it was a little taboo. I remember when Victory Games released Vietnam, that was kind of a big deal when that came out. And that was pretty much the whole Vietnam War. It wasn't squad level combat like Forgotten Heroes is. But funny thing is, there really aren't all that many war games out there that tackle any aspect of the Vietnam War.
Like Platoon, the
yes, for board wasn't game. That TSR? Wasn't that one of the terrible TSR designs? Yeah, I'm almost positive it was a TSR game. I don't think it was SPI. I think it was TSR. I shouldn't say terrible because, to be honest, I never played it,
right.
But I don't recall hearing anything great about it. I remember there was a role-playing game that was Vietnam. I can't think of it off the top of my head what it was. And it's gone through a few different editions, and I think the latest edition is sort of an overall mercenary game, but they do have some Vietnam scenarios in it. I can't remember what the name of it was.
Huh.
That came out early 80s, 82-ish, 83, somewhere in that vicinity. I'm pretty sure I actually have a copy of that floating around somewhere.
Well, for us, when we were growing up in the 80s, the big thing was people who've been trapped in Vietnam.
Oh, yes, right.
Like Uncommon Valor. And
I watched that not too long ago on Netflix.
Did you?
Yes. That movie is horrible. It is terrible. The acting, outside of Gene Hackman, obviously.
Right.
Just horrendous. Randall Tex Cobb is in it. Remember him? He was like a boxer or something. He was like a nobody boxer because he was kind of scary looking and a big dude. Ended up getting in movies and he usually played the heavy. He's in it. The special effects are just terrible. The explosions are so cheap and cheesy. I watched that movie. I was embarrassed to sit here and think to myself, wow, I remember I saw that movie. I think you and I saw it.
Yeah.
And going, man, that was a cool movie. Oh, that was a good movie. What a pile of crap this is. Just terrible. I think it was one of the first movies that Patrick Swayze was in.
Really?
Yeah, he plays a kid, a son of a POW who's in the military or whatever. He was probably 20, 22 years old, maybe. That was before he was telling people that they couldn't put baby in a corner.
I remember seeing Platoon, actually, and actually that blew my mind.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's completely different. Yeah. You know what's another really good movie? Hamburger Hill.
Is that the Clint Eastwood one?
No, you're thinking of Heartbreak Ridge.
Oh, okay. Sorry. That's close.
Yes, Hamburger Hill. It's up there with Platoon, really.
Yeah?
Yeah. I want to say Andre Brower, I think is his name. Really great, awesome actor. He's in it. That's up there with Platoon as far as Vietnam movies.
Wow.
You'll have to check it out. Mm-hmm. Victory Point Games has announced a revamp of Waterloo 20. It was the first title in the series of games featuring low unit density on the map, 20 pieces or less, modest complexity, and dramatic, fast-playing turns. With Napoleon's escape from exile and return to France, his Grand Army is once again on the march. Can the Anglo-Allied forces under Wellington and the Prussian Army under Blücher stop him? Improvements and enhancements to this new edition of Waterloo 20 touch every component, so it's a complete rebirth. Almost say a Waterloo 20 2.0. The map has seen a fresh look at the critical terrain that affects this series' games, and so the addition of several smaller rivers and streams now flow across the landscape. So too were some other geographical features more properly placed, and the setup locations of a few units adjusted. The cards have seen many substitutions to improve the game's narrative, as well as graphics enhancements to bring them up to the latest series standards. The counters have seen an addition of the French Grand Battery Artillery Reserve Unit, the Prussian Advance Guard Cavalry Unit, which begins the game eliminated and awaiting an opportunity to rally as it was broken earlier, slowing down the French approach to Ligny, and a good ground marker to reflect the strong position Blücher defended at Ligny and Wellington found near Waterloo.
The rules include historical and variable weather and a June 18th scenario, the third day, where the pieces begin ready to commence the battles at Wavre and Waterloo. There's even a historical card draw variant for the scenario for those desiring a more scripted Battle of Waterloo. Waterloo 20 Second Edition is available now at Victory Point Games, and the tagline is...
Victory Point Games, where the game plays the thing.
It's like the only thing you ever say about Victory Point Games anymore. Just your tagline.
I just did a review of Y last week, and I'm doing Legions of Darkness this week.
Yeah, whatever. Those games, they have that Victory Point game pedigree.
Right.
Oh, I swear, I was just so tempted to comment on that guy's blog and say, I'm sorry, the States of Siege line doesn't have an auction mechanic in it. And maybe the Napoleonic 20 series doesn't have worker placement in it. Maybe that's why you don't like it.
That's it. There's no medieval trading.
Yes, there's no 17th century Venetian trading merchants.
I'm going to paint Napoleon's headquarters.
And it comes with 500 little wooden cubes. And that kind of leads me back to one of the things that I don't dig about these Euro designs is they harp on the same damn stuff over and over and over again. Yeah. How many games do you really need for 16th century merchant trading? Seriously.
The best century, of course.
Oh, obviously, yes. It seems like these Euro games, the designers are probably from these countries where they developed this game for, let's say, the 15th century, because that was the last time that their country was actually relevant in the world view.
Like Poland.
Hey. Come on, man. Is there something you have against the Poles?
No.
Live right outside Chicago, the city that has the largest Polish population in the world. Yes, this new game is all about Danish merchants. Yeah, okay.
How come there's no games with Danish pastries?
There could be. Hey, you know what? Let's make one.
Food Fight 2.
I've actually noticed there are quite a few different websites out there that cover games and stuff like that. Now they're starting to release their own games. We should do that. We should create our own game. We'll create the Gaming Gang Gaming Company. From the Gaming Gang Games.
Cthulhu meets Napoleon.
All right. I believe you have another review ready.
My second review is Legions of Darkness from Victory Point Games.
Oh, I hate those guys. Ugh.
Oh, I'm telling
you. Oh, jeez. You had to play a game from them?
It's true, yes. Designed by Chris Taylor, it came out in 2011. It's a solitaire game, ages 10 and up, takes about 30 minutes to play. I was drawn to Legions of Darkness because, for one, it's a States of Siege game, and two, it has a fantasy theme. I have enjoyed the States of Siege line, but I like the fantasy and science fiction themes a lot more than the various warfare themes.
I know playing the Lost Cause, you win that game all the time.
Oh, please. But it is an excellent game. It is really an excellent game. Legions of Darkness, designed by Chris Taylor, puts the player in charge of the defenses of a castle besieged by monsters. As is standards in the States of Siege line, there are several tracks along which the various evil armies march towards the castle. There are east and west wall tracks, a gate track, a sky track, and a terror track. The terror track is short, and there's only 3 spaces. That one's only used at night.
It's a short terror, so is it like Chucky?
Reminds me of Trilogy of Terror for some reason. I don't know.
How did Karen Black become an actress with that wandering eye kind of thing going?
Why? It happens, I guess.
She'd have been a lot hotter if she just had worn like a patch. Yeah, and been in pirate film.
There's also a time track, which is used to measure the progress of the game. If you can survive until the marker passes the last space on the time track, then you win the game. Of course, as with any States of Siege game, there's many ways to lose. There's a magic track that measures how much magical energy you have to spend on spell casting. You have both arcane energy for wizard spells and divine energy for clerical spells. There's about a half a dozen of each type of spell, ranging from fireballs to raise dead. They can only be used once per game, so you need to use them sparingly. Completing the tracks on the board are the defender tracks, one each for men-at-arms, archers, and clerics. They start at the highest spaces when the game begins and keep track of how many melee attacks you can make, how many ranged attacks you can make, and the bonus to your chant roll that you receive. Souls America! As your defenders are killed off, you get to make fewer attacks per turn, which can become disastrous if you aren't careful. You'll have heroes on your side to help with the defenses, and they each have their own special abilities. There's six in all, but you only get to use three per game. This adds some replayability value and allows you to mix it up a bit. Your choices include a wizard, cleric, warrior, rogue, paladin, and a ranger. Legions of Darkness comes with two separate scenarios to choose from. The Greenskin Horde pits you against goblins, orcs, trolls, and a dragon. The Undead Scourge scenario has skeletal riders, zombies, a wraith, and the dreaded Nightmare.
I have quite a few of those.
The scenarios have both a specific setup to use and a random setup to shake things up a bit. Once you set up all the various tracks and monster armies and choose your heroes, you'll shuffle the day and night decks of cards separately, and you're ready to begin. Each turn, you select a card from the correct pile based on the time of day on the time track.
Like you'll begin. Noon?
It's 3:27, damn it. You'll begin the game on the first dawn space and move the time counter downward as directed by the card that you draw. Each card shows exactly what you need to do on your turn. The first section shows icons representing the enemy armies that will move. Each icon represents the space on the respective track. If an enemy reaches the zero space on the wall or gate tracks, then the wall or gate is breached.
That ain't good.
No, that's not good. And the second time an enemy reaches the zero space, you lose the game as the army of monsters storms into the keep. When the monsters reach zero on the sky or terror tracks, you automatically lose one defender and move the counter on one of your defender tracks down one space. If all three defender tracks ever reach zero, you lose the game. Next on the card is the event description. Not every card has an event, but for those that do, you simply follow the instructions on the card. You'll usually end up rolling a die and having some positive or negative thing happen. It's usually negative, but don't give up. The next section tells you how many actions and heroic actions you can make that turn, plus any die roll modifiers applicable, like +1 to melee attacks or -1 to a rally roll. Speaking of rally rolls, you also have a morale counter for your troops. If your morale is normal, then nothing happens. If your morale is high, you get +1 action per turn, and if your morale is low, you get -1. Your morale automatically degrades by one level each morning as the sun rises and your troops see that you're still surrounded by horrible monster armies.
I hate waking up to that.
It happens a lot to me over here at the Villa Park Studios.
Oh, man. Roll over in bed and go, oh, geez. Man, how much did I drink? What are you doing here? Oh, I'm sorry. You're talking about the game.
Right, the game.
Sorry.
The actions that you can take on your turn are attack. You can attack one monster army. For the close ones, you can use a melee attack. For the further ones, you'll use a ranged attack. The maximum number of attacks depends on the number of defenders that you have remaining. To attack, you simply roll the die, and if the roll is higher than the defensive value on the monster's counter, you win the attack and push the monsters back one space. And if you fail, nothing happens. You can also build. You can build one of several available upgrades to slow down the attackers. These are placed on space one of a track. There's oil, grease, acid, and lava to help you out.
Wouldn't oil speed them up as they, like, slide?
Whoa! I keep wondering about the lava in all these games. Where are these people coming up with all this lava? Hey, go grab some of that lava.
Well, you know, you could stop them with straw, wood.
Oh my gosh, the monsters are armed with straw.
It's like Eruption.
You'll need to roll higher than the number on the token to actually build them, and acid and lava will require you to roll a value of 6, so it's not that easy. You can cast a spell. You may cast one of your memorized spells, and once you cast the spell, it's lost and the token is discarded.
What is this, like Dungeons and Dragons? Yeah, I learned that spell and then I cast, and damn it, I just for the life of me.
Remember that one?
I won't remember it until I sleep on it.
You can chant. You can have your cleric's chant to attempt to increase your available divine energy. If your roll is successful, you'll add +1 to divine energy on your energy attacks. You can memorize or pray to pull a random spell from the stack of spell tokens. You can use memorize for an arcane spell or pray for a divine spell, but you won't know what it is specifically until you flip it over. And finally, you can quest. Some of the cards have quests listed on them that will give you a benefit if completed. You sacrifice actions to get die roll modifiers, then roll to see if you complete the quest. My first game, I received a magic bow that allowed me to save a +2 ranged attack for when it really came in handy later. And now that's all your available actions. There's also heroic actions that your heroes can launch.
Dun, 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 dun.
Heroes.
Why, it's time for me to step to the fore!
You can cast a heroic spell, rally the troops to increase morale, or move themselves from track to track. Each spell also has a heroic effect that will occur if you use a hero to cast it, and those can really help you out. You'll need the wizard to cast arcane spells and the cleric to cast divine spells. If you don't have them, then no heroic spells for you. There's also some flavor text on the card, and the bottom section will either show you how many spaces to advance the time marker or tell you where to place the bloody battle marker. If you attack an enemy that has the bloody battle marker, you'll automatically lose one defender on the attack. Some cards show nothing at the bottom, so the time track will not advance each turn. It took me 3 cards to finally win one game, and every time I pulled a new card, I had to figure out how to keep it together for one more turn as those monsters killed defender after defender. You continue pulling cards until you either lose the game or win by advancing past the last space on the time track. And that's all there is to it. I found Legions of Darkness a very simple game to learn. It's not as complex as a lot of the other States of Siege games, so if you're interested in the series, I highly recommend picking this one up first as an introduction to the line of games. It's like getting yourself a gateway solitaire game for States of Siege. The game was fun, and it can get a bit desperate at the end, which I do like a lot. It only takes about a half hour to play, and I appreciate the portability of the game. This game would easily fit on an airplane food tray if you would be willing to pull it out on a plane. And my only complaint is that there's no way to track used action, and I can forget this easily during a turn. If they added a card with an action and heroic action track on it, plus 2 different tokens to track them, it would have helped me personally out a lot.
Or included on the map.
Yeah, or included on the map. But the map is pretty full, so that's why I was thinking a little separate card. Legions of Darkness definitely gets a recommendation from me for introducing yourself to the States of Siege line, or if you really enjoy a good fantasy theme.
Isn't there an expansion to it as well, Victory Point Games now?
They do have an expansion for it. I haven't played it, though, so I'm not exactly sure what it's all about, but I am hoping to check that out.
I think it adds some different opponents.
Yeah, that would make
might
sense.
Might be what it is. Probably adds a few options to the game as well.
I should make one more note. They do include this player aid card, which summarizes all the rules really nicely, so that you don't have to go back and refer to the rule book constantly, like in many other games.
Right.
Yeah, their player aid card is very complete. The only thing it did not have, there's different things that happen at dawn when you reach the dawn mark on the time track, and there's different things that happened at twilight, and it didn't have that listed anywhere or on the board, so I had to go back and page through the rules for that. But other than that, it had everything else listed, so I got through the games pretty quick with not a lot of paging through those rules.
Very nice.
It's a good game.
Cool deal. Our final review, interestingly enough, is our 200th review overall.
Woo!
Yeah, pretty amazing. It is the 200th review, be it if it's a written review or some of the exclusives that we've only done on the podcast or just on the website. Regardless, it is the 200th game that we've reviewed at the Gaming Gang. And that game is Fast Action Battle Sicily from GMT, designed by Rick Young, released in 2011. It's for 2 players, and gameplay is between about 2 to 4 hours, and the retail price is $60. Fast Action Battle Sicily, or as I'm going to call it, FABS, is the...
Fabulous!
I knew that was coming! is the second title in the Fast Action Battle series from designer Rick Young, and covers the Allied invasion of Sicily in 1943. The series is meant to be a lower complexity war game for the masses, as opposed to one that strictly appeals to the grognard crowd. This being said, don't be fooled by the title Fast Action Battles, because this is not going to be a game you bust out with a friend who somehow thinks that something along the lines of Memoir 44 or Axis and Allies is a medium complexity war game. I'm not trying to dissuade anyone from buying Fast Action Battles Sicily, but it's important to note that for your average war gamer, the complexity may be on the lower end of the scale, but for your average overall gamer, it's going to be toward the higher end, at least to begin with. Fabs is a Fog of War block game, in which each unit is a small wooden block with a sticker on one side, viewable to the player controlling those forces, while the other side of the block is blank. Columbia Games has built an entire company on titles of this sort, and I happen to be a fan of them. The Commands and Colors line from GMT is another excellent example of this kind of system that uses the block format. Fabs pumps this up a bit because not only do you have your block units, but you also have various counters that represent different assets become available to you during the game. These counters could represent anything from naval bombardments, ranger units, armor, engineers, even fuel or command staff, depending on the scenario being played. As far as most things GMT, the components for Fabs are very nice, as far as the wooden blocks and the stickers, the counters, the rulebook, the playbook, and such. I suppose my only gripe is the map is well presented and it's very nicely designed, but it's not a mounted map, but simply heavy stock. Readers and listeners already know I'm a huge fan of GMT, but I have to say, even with the wooden blocks and all, including a cardboard map in a game that carries a $60 price tag isn't going to go over well with some. Sekigahara from GMT came with what would seem to be the same amount of wood, and although there weren't counters, there were cards included, and that had a mounted board, and that carried a price tag a buck lower than Fast Action Battle Sicily. In the end, it will come down to the gameplay to see if Fabs is worth the purchase. Fast Action Battle Sicily is turn-based, and the Allies always go first, followed by the Axis. Each player will receive reinforcements and assets at the beginning of the turn, and then the Allies will move operationally, move units strategically. Those that are designated as reserve units, enter combat, allow the Axis to react with their own strategic movement, move units that have broken through, resolve breakthrough combat, and then check for supply. The Axis player then takes their turn, and once that's finished, a victory check is made to see if either force has won. If victory hasn't been achieved, it's on to the next turn. All of this is pretty much old hat as an I-go-you-go style of gameplay. This does lead to a bit of downtime, but this is pretty traditional. And since this is a two-player game, if you can't be bothered to pay attention to your opponent, you might as well just settle in on the couch with your Wii controller in your hand and just give up board games altogether. Most of this is pretty straightforward, although combat resolution has a variety of steps to resolve and damage determination can be a bit tricky. In most block games, each force has a certain level that's displayed at the top of the block. As losses are taken, the block is rotated to indicate the reduced strength, or what is sometimes called a step reduction. When reinforcements are applied to that unit, the block is rotated again to indicate the reinforced strength. All in all, it's a fairly simple procedure. In Fabs, damage resolution plays a bit differently, as the attacker can abort an attack. The defender can reduce hits taken by removing defensive works, or can simply retreat among other ways to avoid taking that step reduction. This might take a bit for someone to get their head around, as it did I, as it's radically different than what one normally encounters in a block-based war game. The system does work, and although it's a bit fiddly, you can come to grips with it within a couple of turns, which leads to the fiddly conversation. As Fast Action Battles Bulge, the first game of the series, had the unofficial moniker of Fiddly Action Battles. Not having played Fab-b-b- I can't speak to that title's criticism, but it appears to me that the same holds true with Fabs as well. There are a lot of situational exceptions one has to refer to from time to time, and the way the rules are originally presented, you'll spend quite a bit of time flipping through the book to find what you're looking for. I can say that GMT did produce a new rule book as part of their Living Rules section for Fast Action Battle Sicily in mid-January, and the new book is a great help. Also, the playbook is almost almost completely made up of examples of play, so that comes as a tremendous asset as well in learning the game. You'll also find an introductory map and scenario in which to get your feet wet before you tackle the larger scenarios. I feel the biggest selling point of Fast Action Battles Sicily is the situation it simulates. Both the Allies and Axis have their own quandaries to chew over, and although the Allies have a bit of an advantage in my opinion, this isn't a cakewalk for them by any stretch of the imagination. As the Axis player, you have to continually use the Sicilian terrain to your advantage while you delay the Allied advance. Keeping in mind the Italian morale continues to degrade, unless the Allied player is completely screwing the pooch, the Axis have to continually pull back to shorten their lines while doing their best to hold on to critical map objectives. Opportunities for counter thrusts will usually appear, and these have to be jumped on immediately. German units also have to be taken advantage of, and not using them effectively will spell doom for the Axis player. The Allies might have an easier time, but they still have to deal with the difficult terrain as they do their best to stretch the defenders as thin as possible. Not using special assets at the right time to circumvent defenses can leave the Allies in a pinch, while not securing airfields leaves the Luftwaffe available to negate gaining any sort of air superiority. The Allied player needs to focus on making flanking beach landings to cut off Axis routes of retreat, while at the same time ensuring units aren't vulnerable to counterattacks due to overconfidence. The bottom line is I certainly recommend Fast Action Battles Sicily, although probably not as an introduction to wargaming as some may suggest. I feel it's a great title for someone who already has a fairly basic knowledge of wargames under their belt, or for those who don't expect a rulebook to be 5 pages in length. For those out there who are veterans, this is still a great title since there's a lot more meat to the system than what you might normally find in a Fog of War block game. The situation is one that games out with a historic feel to the results, whatever they happen to be in any given gameplay. And the way the map is laid out and the victory conditions set, fighting will rage all across Sicily as opposed to units just all stacking up on one spot on the board. Both combatants have interesting challenges they have to face, and a complete game can be finished within 3.5 hours or so once you have the rules under your belt. All in all, I think Fast Action Battles Sicily is an excellent addition to any wargamer's shelf, and those who have an interest in World War II or the actions that took place in Sicily itself should give it a try as well.
Excellent.
So there you have it, another episode of The Gaming Gang in the books. Elliot, was there anything else that you wanted to add?
Nope, I'm cool, man.
Nope, he's cool, man. All right, why don't you take us out?
You've been listening to the Gaming Gang Podcast with Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller. If you'd like to know more about the topics or games we discussed in this episode, please visit our website at www.thegaminggang.com. If you would like to have your opinion heard or have a gaming issue you'd like us to discuss on a future podcast, you can visit the Gaming Gang Guild on BoardGameGeek or call us at 480-779-7365 and leave a message. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please rate us on iTunes. Some of the games discussed on our show were provided to the Gaming Gang in the form of review copies. On behalf of everyone here at the Gaming Gang, thanks for listening.